Hi, this is Pastor Chris, and welcome to Strength for Today from Living Hope Baptist Church in Geneva, New York. Today is Tuesday, May 19th, 2020. There's a scene in the movie Miracle on 34th Street in which the man who calls himself Kris Kringle is receiving a psychological examination. Shows himself to be perfectly healthy as he's able to rattle off all the right answers. This sets the stage for another scene later in which he deliberately fails the exam, causing him to be committed to a mental hospital because one little girl does not believe in him. Every time I see that film, I muse that the author or the scriptwriter was one acquainted with mental illness, or at least acquainted with psychological examinations. I say that as someone who has gone through many such exams himself. The questions the doctors ask Kris Kringle are very similar to the ones they still give. When my depression finally got the better of me in 1985, I found myself in the emergency room of a hospital undergoing my first psychological exam. I was in one of those windowless, cheerless, cinder block and drywall rooms in the bowels of a crowded, bustling building, perched on an examination table, trying not to move too much so I wouldn't make the paper under my butt crackle, and waiting, simultaneously anxious and bored, just waiting for the door to open and someone to enter. Anyone. A nurse, a tech, a doctor. Well, the door finally opened and a young man in a white coat stepped into the room. He didn't look at me, but stepped over to a stool with wheels on it, seated himself on it, and rolled toward me as he looked over some papers on the clipboard he was carrying. Finally, he glanced up. "Mr. Pellet," he said, mispronouncing my name. "Yes," I said. "My name is," and I can't remember his name as I never ever saw him again, "and I'm a resident here. I will be administering your psychological evaluation." He asked some basic questions about my background, where I was from, why I'd moved to New York, my age, and those sorts of things. I noticed he didn't write down any of my answers, but sort of compared them with the papers on his clipboard, sort of nodding as I went, and then he sort of with a, "yep, there's another one he got right" manner. I figured he was just checking to see whether I was so out of touch with reality that I didn't know who I was or where I was from. Fair enough. But then, having finished those preliminaries, he launched into the exam proper. This consisted of small mental tasks and questions, all delivered in a rapid, somewhat bored manner. "What day is today? What's the date? Who's the president? Who's the vice president? I'm going to list three things, and I want you to remember them and tell me later what they are. The three are a nickel, a pin, and a chair. Okay, now count backwards from 100 by sevens." And on and on and on. Each time I answered, he made a mark on his clipboard and then moved on to the next question. Then he finally asked, "What were those three items?" "A nickel, a pin, and chair," I answered. Okay, he made another mark. And then he asked, "Now what does this mean to you? People who live in glass houses should not throw stones." I paused. This was the first interesting question he had asked. This saying, I believe, is something known as a proverb, a pithy saying that captures some moral truth or common sense proposition in a memorable way. This one, if I'm not mistaken, uses a metaphor to make the point. So I sat there and I thought about it. At the most basic, literal level, I guess, it means that people who live in houses constructed of glass should not throw rocks lest they break the glass. Duh. That interpretation, though, however, does rest on a few assumptions, though, doesn't it? First, most obvious assumption is that this person does not wish to break the glass, or these people do not. Indeed, if they were confined to a glass house and they wished to escape, and they had access to stones, well, the most reasonable thing might be to cast the stones, break the glass, and make good their escape. But I mused, in such sayings, at least in these metaphorical sort, the literal sense is rarely primary. So in my mind there, as I sat, trying not to crinkle the paper under me, I took out the elements, thought through them, live, house, glass, stone, throw, and I thought about each one. With the term live, there was an implication of a passing of time. This living, it seemed to me, was the habitual dwelling of these conjectural people. That, taken along with the preposition in, suggested to me that they are dwelling within the structure over a period of time, voluntarily or involuntarily. Assuming the former, for the sake of the argument, I started to think of what that word lives might symbolize. Exist? Thrive? Advance? Survive? I wondered, was it meant to be active or passive? Then the term houses came to mind. That's a word pointing at a structure used primarily for the sheltering of individuals or families, to be distinguished from a building, a factory, or other commercial structure. It seems to symbolize resting, safety, security, or retreat. And of all these terms, I thought as I sat there, glass was the most interesting, because when I think of glass, I think of beauty and transparency, but also rigidity and fragility. You can see right through it, and it can keep out the rain, but it can break pretty easily, too. Now, after all this time, I'm still there sitting there thinking, the resident started tapping on his clipboard. "Mr. Pellet," he said, "I need some sort of response." Then I got all flustered and threw out the first thing that came out, something trite like, "Well, it means that you shouldn't criticize other people for their faults when you've got all kinds of faults of your own." And with this answer, the resident seemed content, made some notes on the clipboard, and then stood up and left. Like I said, I never saw him again. I had a lot of time over the next year to think about that proverb. You have a lot of free time on a mental unit. And I guess the fact that I kept thinking about it may say a little bit about why I was there. I still find it interesting that the interpretation of proverbs is still a part of psychological and neurological testing. I suppose that one's ability to interact with such sayings indicates one's capacity to engage in abstract thinking. In my case, I think it just demonstrated my obsessive-compulsive disorder. Well, regardless, by this point, you're probably wondering what any of this has to do with the Sermon on the Mount. Well, that's a good question. The answer is that the verse at which we arrive today contains a parable. It is as if, at this point of his sermon, Jesus decided to administer a psychological exam. No, probably not. But what he does do is include a proverb to underscore and illustrate principles he has been teaching. And this proverb will indeed test our capacity for abstract reasoning as we seek to tease out his intended meaning and apply it to our lives. We find this proverb in Matthew chapter 7, verse 6. Jesus says, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." As I shared with you my thinking about the glass house proverb, you probably thought my musings were excessive and unwarranted. And to be honest, I agree with you. It's a man-made proverb that may or may not have some truth to it. Spending a lot of time pondering it is probably not the best use of time. But when we come to this proverb here in Matthew, we are dealing with something of an entirely different nature. We are in it receiving a command from the one who is the truth. And since it comes from him whom we call Lord, it is imperative that we understand and obey it. So to me, it seems reasonable to slow down and think about what it means. And let's do that for just a moment here. It begins this way, "Do not give what is holy to the dogs." We are immediately forced to make some interpretive decisions here. What is that which is holy? And to what or whom does the dogs refer? We also must make some quick observations, for instance, that this holy thing is something Jesus assumes his followers have. The word holy means set apart, and I think to the ears of Jewish listeners in Jesus' day, it would have presented a stark contrast to his use of the word dogs. The Jews were to be a holy people, a people set apart to and for God, as they had been purchased by him and redeemed out of Egypt. They were supposed to be, but of course not every physical Jew in that day was truly holy. In fact, the thrust of the Sermon on the Mount has been to this point that a holiness must be realized that transcends the outward holiness that the Jews had sought before, or many of them. Still, Jesus is not here speaking of holiness generically, but rather of something specifically holy. To know what this holy thing is, I think we should look back at the immediate context. In the previous five verses, Jesus spoke of judging others. As I observed before, he was not telling his followers never to judge others, but to do so warily, after great self-examination, in a spirit of humility. This, I think, helps us identify what it is that can be deemed holy. In verses 1 through 5, Jesus was speaking of addressing outward actions as the fruit of conformity or nonconformity to God's perfect moral law. He exhorted his followers to examine themselves carefully in light of that law, and I would suggest to recognize and confess their absolute dependency on God for the imputation of righteousness. Then, and only then, is it appropriate for them to serve others by pointing out to them their mutual need for that righteousness. This testimony to another, this testimony concerning the righteousness of God and the unrighteousness of man, is holy. Indeed, though the reality of condemnation comes in general revelation, it is only in special revelation that we learn of God's rescue plan, the giving of His Son, and the imputation of Jesus' righteousness. And this, of course, is perfect, right, and absolutely morally pure. It is holy. And those who follow Jesus have been given this treasure, though, of course, we carry it in earthenware vessels. I can see why it might be tempting at this point to equate that which is holy with the proclamation of the gospel. But frankly, I think this would be misguided and going beyond the text. Rather, I would suggest that which is holy is the sure word of condemnation for all who trust in their own righteousness and the message of hope for deliverance only available as a gift from God. But let's turn to the dogs for a moment. We could, of course, think very literally about this and suggest that the idea is simply don't take something precious and throw it to the ground to be abused by those who have no right to it. And that would be true. But I don't think we can ignore the fact that Jews in those days referred to Gentiles as dogs. They were, in the common mind, profane, unholy, dwelling outside the covenant or the people of God. If this lurks behind his words, Jesus is, I think, referring to those who are outside a covenant relationship with God. Such thoughts, I suspect, have lent themselves to extreme Calvinistic thinking and the failure to share the gospel. And again, I would suggest and believe that this is misguided, as we must build practice upon that which is clear, and as I have maintained, a reference to the gospel proclamation has not been established here. So then, who are these dogs? Well, let me see if this helps. The dogs are those who receive the holy thing with indifference, who are incapable of recognizing its holiness, and will, accordingly, treat it with disdain and contempt. But doesn't this require discernment on the part of Jesus' followers? Clearly, yes. As those who have been entrusted with the holy thing, his followers must exercise good stewardship over its sharing, discerning whether those with whom it could be shared will treat it with the respect it deserves. And that discernment requires dependency of God's Holy Spirit, I assume. And that is probably a topic for another day. So how would I restate the exhortation here? Recognize who will treat theological truth with disdain and don't give it to them. Is that right? Well, it sounds harsh, doesn't it? But if it is, the harshness of the action or the reaction really is in keeping with the hardness of the recipient's heart. Because the other person's heart is discerned to be hard, the response is harsh. But who, one might ask, is able to soften anyone's heart? And that's a good question, and one which leads, I think, to a discussion of prevenient grace. But again, that's another topic that we'll have to wait. The next part of the proverb reads this way, "Nor cast your pearls before swine." Both terms, pearls and swine, are evocative. Pearls speak, of course, of great value, and the mention of them here reminds me, and probably you, of Jesus' parable about the pearl of great price, of the merchant who sold all that he had so that he could purchase that one pearl of surpassing beauty. So it speaks of something of great value, something highly praised, so here, heavenly wisdom. The impotency of our own righteousness and our desperate need for God's own righteousness. The word swine denotes an unclean animal, as we all know. It's a reference to the pig. And to the Jew, the pig was detestable, ceremonially unclean, the antithesis of holiness. So again, here, the picture is of taking something of extraordinarily great value and throwing it down among those who will treat it with disdain and defile it. The verse then takes a sobering turn as Jesus states the consequences of ignoring his command. When he says, "Lest they trample them under their feet and turn and tear you in pieces." This part of the verse is not difficult to understand, is it? If we fail to show discernment, and we do proclaim these truths to the wrong people, they very well may stomp on our truths, arguing against them and ridiculing them, and then when they are finished with that, they may attack us personally. So they might attack the ideas first, and then us second. And Jesus warns this could turn out violent and deadly. And of course, you will notice as I spoke that I broadened my interpretation here. There is, I think, another narrower possible interpretation, and that has simply to do with the confronting of another's sin. Let's say you see your brother sinning, and you feel compelled to say something. You engage, as you ought, in self-examination, and you come to the conclusion that you are indeed motivated by a desire for God's glory and by love for your brother. All is fine, and all is good. At this point, in keeping with this interpretation, you would pause and consider the character of your brother. Does he have a teachable spirit? Does he love the Lord? How will he respond to your comment? Then, if you are satisfied that his response will be respectful, then you should proceed. Notice I didn't say that you would only approach your brother if it seemed he would agree with you. The criteria by which you would choose to proceed or not is the reverence with which you anticipate he would receive the comments. Well, I don't think these two interpretations are mutually exclusive. The second one is a narrow application of the first, I think. So there it is. I must admit, this verse raises many more questions for me, ones we don't have time to address here. And when I encounter a verse like that, I try to keep an open mind and keep on pondering, keep on thinking about what it means, trying to apply it again and again to my life. Now, proverbs about glass houses may not be worth prolonged thought, but the ones in God's Word always are. This reminds me of another proverb, one found in Proverbs 25, verse 2. It reads this way. It says, "It is the glory of God to conceal a matter, but the glory of kings is to search out a matter." And we'll end today with just one more proverb, one I know is true because of all that God has done for us in and through Jesus Christ. It is, "The best is yet to come." God bless.